And the TechNet is continuously evolving. We think we've got an improvement tonight. You'll be hearing John giving us a little bit more information about it. K2UPS and among other people, a number of people have said how difficult it is to sign in with IRLP or Echolink, particularly Echolink. There are times where what happens, I think, and we see it when the East Coast machine, when the Eastern machine on Long Island and the West machine on Long Island are linked together. I'm K2LAW, by the way, and this is the beginning of the TechNet. When those two machines are linked together, there are times when they are first linked where the latency, the delay time between the two by way of the website connection is a tenth of a second. And for some reason I don't understand, sometimes that delay time starts climbing up to very long periods of time. I'm guessing that that might be one of the factors where various people have complained that if we don't let the machine thoroughly drop, then they don't get a chance to chime in with Echolink when they're out of the immediate area. Let me drop.
Dick.
And as John will be announcing tonight, what John's going to be doing is he's going to be monitoring the website itself, for which he knows how many people are on Echolink, how many people are trying to sign in. So we're going to monitor that. So if you're on Echolink or IRL, Echolink in particular, and you want to chime in, we're going to start keeping track of how many people sign in by Echolink and how many people are trying to get in. So we're going to try to solve this problem. It sounds like you've got another suggestion also, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead with your suggestion, Joe.
You don't have to let the machine completely drop. I think I've told you this first before on the telephone. The IRP sends out packets, and the packets get compressed because you're using a not full bandwidth net connection up there where the repeater is. And the longer you talk, the more these packets get compressed. And finally, the timing between what you're saying on 146.25 when it comes out the other end gets very additive in time. Initially, if you make a quick transmission, there might be a half a second delay or something like that. But as you talk longer and longer and longer, this becomes more pronounced. And it becomes very pronounced when you don't let the time, the machine reset at all, and you keep on becoming additive. And eventually, sometimes I've heard you actually knock people off the reflector. That's another problem that happens from time to time. If it sees a continuous series of key up or continuous key up for like 4 minutes or whatever. I've done some listening, and I can tell you about 3 seconds of delay between the time you let the mic go and wait for the other guy at the other end of the IRLP to check in. It'll probably work very nicely. You shouldn't have to let the machine completely drop. 3 seconds should probably do it, which is longer than what your courtesy tone is.
That doesn't apply to Echolink. It's even longer. Yeah, I'm going to ask both Eric and Joe this one. Eric, not only does the digital code start piling up, so to speak, and the latency of the internet connection starts getting longer for reasons I don't understand. Also, there are times when poor old Rich K2UPS wants to talk to us, and all of a sudden his voice starts sounding like single sideband, and the machine drops out. And I know that you're working on that, Eric, and I know it's a tough problem. I'm going to send it over to you, Eric, if you want to say a few words on all of the above. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. What the other gentleman said in terms of the panic going up, that's true, and IRLP. It's true to some degree with Echolink, too. Echolink is a longer path. Everything is directed by service. Why 5 seconds? It's kind of hard to explain. It's a combination of ingredients. It's just the client end as much as it's the server end. IRLP is much better behaved about it. But one of the things about IRLP, if you listen to most reflectors, they'll say, pick up the mic and wait for 2 seconds before speaking. You got to let the control packets go through first. As far as when you originally make a connection and you have this huge amount of latency, it could simply be in the past. In the broadcast world, we run into trouble like that every now and then. You get a good path, you could be talking 100 milliseconds. You get a path that's bouncing all over the country and turns into seconds, and then we can drop it and try again. K2RWP.
information. I'd also like to know what was happening 1 week ago or 2 weeks ago, I'm not sure which, where one of the people signing in, I think by EchoLink, something about the way his rig was adjusted. At the beginning of each transmission, it would transmit a tone, and the net result of it, sort of like a whistle-up tone, I guess it was, maybe it's sort of the European standard, and that in turn caused the EchoLink to blank the first few seconds of audio. So each time the person tried signing in, we could hear the suffix of his call letters. We could never hear the prefix because the tone was causing this delay. I'd like to know a little bit about what's going on there, if you happen to have an explanation for that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW. It's LAW, K2EJ. I happened to be listening to that, and he was not coming over at the link. He was using his K2 radio with the wires function turned on. He just wasn't aware of it. It does exactly as you described. It sends a tone out, which is an alert tone to the wires receiver, and it blanks the audio for the first 3 seconds, 2.5 seconds, whatever it is, I forget. But you can make any radio do that, and most people don't. So that's the explanation to that one. Oh, by the way, why it sounds like single sideband is because of the feedback loop, just the way it connected into the controller, and I've got a little fix to that, and I got a little board which is going to take care of that. But we've got more inputs going into the controller than the input ones than the controller understands how to handle. So, anyway, that's the reason. K2IWK2J.
This reminds me a little bit of the episode I lived through at Airborne Instruments Laboratory way back in the dark ages on the early days of developing the counter circuit, the thing that did the display of the exact frequency it was on for the spectrum analyzer. And somewhere buried into that counter was a divide by three circuit, a digital divide by three. And the way the digital divide by three was wired, there was a way where once in a thousand seconds, so to speak, a glitch would occur in the digital signals being sent from one JK flip-flop to the next, where it would go into a crazy mode where the thing would hang up. And because of the way lots of printed circuit boards were built with that particular layout, we didn't want to abandon that exact circuit. So to solve it, I had to build a circuit that recognized the signature of the hang-up mode, and when it saw that signature, it would give a reset to all of the JK flip-flops, and everything would start all over again. A guy watching the screen would never know it, because all of that would take place in a few milliseconds. So I am guessing that with the single sideband sound that K2UPS occasionally has, you have discovered a signature that you can recognize, and therefore you hit some kind of a reset with your circuit that you're generating, Eric, that it's going to make that problem go away. Is that the potential solution right now, where finding the real cause is probably a hell of a lot more difficult than simply solving it once you can recognize it, so to speak? Bunch of guesses on my part. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Now, I know the exact reason. It's actually, look, the controller is really a 3x3 matrix. It's got three more auxiliary inputs. The matrix is selected by the computer, okay, and these auxiliary inputs is what we're using to get EchoLink and a few other services. So essentially, we have to write a macro to flip that matrix, that audio path, on and off. And what happens is, unfortunately, the computer controller is interrupted. It prioritizes what gets done when. And sometimes, when EchoLink is happening and he comes back, he's actually creating a feedback loop through the EchoLink input and the EchoLink output, and it causes that flat-topping distortion that sounds like sideband. And I have a fix to that. It's really just a method of controlling and muting the audio coming out, going in and out, and it's just having got to put it in there.
Yeah, you need a hobby, Eric. Seems like you're maintaining VHF and UHF equipment out in Selden. VHF, UHF, maybe even some SHF equipment in Glen Oaks.
a broadcast station in New York City, a broadcast station in Plainview, and building a house. What do you do in your spare time?
And he works on the motive system.
Yes.
Forget that I also have four FM stations and another video facility that I deal with. Oh, and two low-power TV transmitters.
Yeah, you need a hobby. So despite these minor little picadillos you got there, this fix on the single sideband sound of K2UPS, make a rough guess. 2 or 3 weeks, that problem may go away. Go to you, Eric, K3J, K2RIW.
No, I can't give you a definitive answer because I'm wanting to make up some new harnesses and rewire a bunch of stuff rather than just tape something in there, which I just might do for the meantime. But I refrain from putting the digital repeater on until after tonight, because that's my next little experiment. I'll do that for a few days, and then maybe I'll get to the other thing, because that's not the only thing you're doing.
Okay, for you guys who have tuned in late, or even tuned in early, we're making a very unorthodox start to the TechNet tonight. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB. He maintains the mailbag, and he's now going to be doing a whole bunch of computer monitoring you're going to be hearing about. We got Paul, WS2N, who keeps telling me what Voyager is doing, but he really tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And we've got Hal, K6DPZ, who gives us the more brief answers and also gives us the benefit of the zillions of pieces of equipment that he has worked with in all of his life. And if you happen to go to his website, you'll see ham radio and test equipment heaven, where he's got lots and lots of stuff. Also, we didn't catch him early enough. I thought he was in the automobile and going to be there for a couple of hours when he was coming back from Dayton, and he was going to give us a Dayton report. So if he's in there late tonight, early tonight, we'll take his delayed Dayton report. I'd like to hear a little bit about how bad was the hail when he was experiencing it in Dayton, Ohio at the Hammerama. Let me drop.
E6DPZ is here.
Okay. So let's start off with you, because you didn't get a chance to talk last week, so I'm going to put you number one on the runway. And so you can accelerate at the pilot's discretion. K60PZ, K2RIW, and the TechNet. What was that Dayton like, Hal?
K2RIW and the TechNet, K60PZ. Hello to Dick and everybody else on the net tonight. Well, what was it like? First of all, I didn't even get a chance to go into the main arena. I got there on Thursday night. I went in on Friday, started covering the outside flea market, and on Saturday, between dodging the raindrops and the hail, covered almost all the outside flea market. And by the time I looked on Saturday, it was already almost 4:30, 5 o'clock, and it was time to go. And Sunday I left in the morning. As far as the outside market, there's quite a bit of stuff there. I don't think there was as much stuff there as I saw last year. I saw a lot more arrogance there, though, meaning that asking different people about equipment and prices, they were very fixed on their prices. And the answers I got from a lot of people, well, if I don't sell it here, I'll drag it back and put it on eBay. So my comment to them was, why would you bother dragging it to begin with? You just sort of saved the step and just sold it on eBay. So all in all, you know, it was interesting. I had a lot of fun, saw a lot of people I knew, and drove both ways with me and my XYL in Mendel, who was my resident Shetland sheepdog. By matter of fact, 6 hours driving, he just, first 15 minutes in the car, hold on, I don't want to drop out, he just watched how the road looked, went to sleep for about almost the whole trip. When we stopped to get some lunch, I said, you want to go out? He raised his head, looked at me, and went back to sleep. Made it to the hotel, and was a perfect animal the whole time in the hotel, and then the perfect animal coming back on the Sunday morning. So that's my report on Dayton, and I'll be here until 9 o'clock. If somebody wants a quickie answer on any question that's within my realm. So back to you, Dick, K2RIW, This is K6 Dirty Purple Zombies.
Now, I know you're not allowed to advertise your particular business, so to speak, over ham radio. However, I'm making a request. And if you think it's appropriate, answer it. I'd like people to, from time to time, be able to see the pictures of your equipment, which is quite extensive. So is there an easy way that you can tell somebody the URL they can go to see the equipment that you have control over? How? K6DPZ, K2LIW?
URIW, K6DPZ. I'm sure there are other people on the net right now who could very easily come on and get my website. I don't want to be nailed for commercializing. I already got a letter anonymously from somebody saying if I commercialize, they're going to report me to the FCC. So if anybody's on frequency who could pass on that information, I'm going to keep mum about it. Go ahead.
Do we like it to that, Dick?
Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, it's a little confusing, but landaircom.com. Landaircom.com. Which is very interesting. And Dick, please put me down, hopefully the number one on the runway. I've got something very interesting, I think, from TechNet. So it's landaircom.com. Back to net.
Okay, thank you for that information. And a person goes to www.landaircom.com. And the conventional spelling that I think there's no punctuation in there except for the .com at the end. And there's another .com before that. Alrighty. And you'll see ham radio heaven, or you'll see test equipment heaven. Lots and lots of stuff. So we got Rich and two EO signed in. I'm pretty sure Bill wants to sign in, AC2IS. We got Joe, WA2RYY. Anyone else wants to sign into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment for us tonight? Give me a call, that is right now. K2RYW in the TechNet.
KD2FQU with a question.
Okay, KD2, it sounds like Foxtrot Delta Uniform. Please correct me on the letters and also tell me your handle. KD2FDU question mark, K2LIW.
KD2FQU, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform, name's John.
Very fine, John, we got you. Anyone else want to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
This is AC2IS Bill. No question or comment other than looking for another signal report.
Okay, I had signed you in. And whatever you've changed, you've made a significant improvement, Bill. A lot more audio. And it sounds like more signal. Almost all the noise has disappeared. And as I've said to you often, even though your house is on a fairly low piece of land and it's somewhat landlocked out there in Setauket, if you did put any kind of yucky antenna on the chimney of the house, a coat hanger antenna made as a ground plane and/or Yagi, and the coat hanger Yagis, which would cost you $3 worth of materials, WA5EJB.com, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo.com, and you go to the second page of his website, and he'll show you a beautiful design of 2-meter Yagi antennas that you can build with a stick of wood and coat hanger wire, and it will make your signal a hell of a lot stronger. The combination of the gain of that antenna and some altitude of the antenna would make your signal that on many weeks has been quite weak, would make it an awful lot stronger. So no matter where we live, we can always put out a lot more RF because in the case of VHF, like 2 meters, altitude is what really makes an antenna work. Gain after that adds icing on the cake. Let me drop. Okay, so let's start off with Rich. N2EO. What new piece of equipment have you discovered, Rich? quite possibly a piece of equipment that helps people with a medical
I was walking for the first time on the prosthetic leg, what they call an artificial leg, so they'll understand what that means. He had to take it back to do some finalizing, and I'll give it. Or maybe nobody's interested, and that's okay.
So you've had your first fitting, and it sounds like another fitting is going to happen. I think I heard you say earlier tonight that, or today or yesterday, that the leg consists of titanium in some places, probably other exotic materials like Teflon, but titanium. And I think you said it was the German design, the overall design, and when it's properly fitted and when the proper training occurs and the proper muscles are built up, I think some people with a prosthetic leg have almost as much mobility as they would have had in the earlier days of their life. In fact, one of those guys even runs a marathon on one of those things. N2EO, K2LID, go ahead there, Rich.
Okay, again, N2EO, yes, I'm very excited about it.
$20 white book out of
Sid Harvey is the name of the company that sells oil burner components. With that $20 book with beautiful illustrations and explanations as to how to maintain an oil-fired furnace, or a gas-fired furnace, but mostly oil. With that, maybe you're not going to get there immediately, but you're eventually going to be joining Joe, me, and oh, there's probably 30 guys on the within the sound of my voice. Let me drop it. There's probably 30 guys within the sound of my voice who have been able to maintain their own oil burner. And an oil burner, even though traditionally people don't do that, they always hire somebody to do it. We consider it rocket science. It's not. It's a hell of a lot less complicated than many of the ham radio pieces of equipment that we use. So I think eventually you'll be maintaining your oil burner and getting a lot more efficiency out of it. And the way they're being set, Erwin Dresner, 32 PR, that is it? Keep forgetting Erwin's call letters. Anyhow, Erwin Dresner did that research to find out that a high percentage of the oil burners on Long Island are not being set correctly. Okay. One of the things that we're going to do periodically is John is going to chime in, KC2WGB. He is monitoring the website. Let me drop. From now on, at the suggestions of some people, and I'm surprised we didn't think of this earlier, he's going to monitor the website where people check in with Echo Link, and I think there's even a similar place where a person can check in with IRLP. But what I'm getting at is John's going to monitor how many people are listening to the TechNet, how many people are attempting to get in. So that problem we've had for years, where if we don't leave a long enough delay between the three or four beeps and then sometimes some extra time in there, so the system resets so that a person in the outer areas doesn't get a chance to talk to us. We're going to try to correct that by way of monitoring that website. So please pass the word around for those who have given up on trying to get in with EchoLink because of the frustration of always being timed out, so to speak. We think we've got a solution to that. So we're working on it. The TechNet is always evolving. Okay, let us know how things go in the future, Rich. The next person who signed in, because he's always got a question, is Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. So how are those electrons treating you tonight, Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet?
Oh, just great, Dick. They treat me just great. This is a simple, I guess you probably categorize this as a simple physics question, but I'll just let it loose anyway, because you said you can bring any question you want to bring to the TechNet, okay? We know that some things are what we call, I guess, endless or not measurable. Alright? How about electromagnetic radiation, or basically stuff that emanates in the frequency domain, whether it be RF or light? Is there a limit to the highest frequency that something can be, or is it just something that we can't detect beyond a certain point? In other words, we know that there's energy that goes up to ultraviolet, X-ray, cosmic, gamma rays. Is it something above that? Is there a limit to the limit of the actual, I guess, a ceiling, so to speak, of frequency as you would measure it in as short as a wavelength might possibly be? Back to you, Dick.
Not sure what makes you think that that's not a good ham radio question, Joe. It is. One of the things that I've said so often, you're hearing a little bit of a philosophy, but I've got 40-some-odd years of experience with this philosophy, and it always has worked. See, whenever it comes to something that you cannot see, no human being has ever seen a molecule. You can't take a picture of one. The highest power microscope in the world is not going to show you what a molecule or an atom of any material looks like. On top of that, the subcomponents of that atom. There's an electron in there. There's a bunch of protons in that nucleus, protons and neutrons. And the protons and neutrons have got other things inside of them called quarks, smaller and smaller and smaller. No one has ever seen an atom or a molecule. We've built up over the years a model of what we think the atom looks like, what the molecule looks like. And as you do further and further testing and you find some errors, you modify the model. So we've got a model in our mind, so to speak, of what's going on. Something very similar is taking place with a radio wave. What does a radio wave really look like? What does its frequency look like? What does its wavelength look like? I've described it with the bubble theory. If you go to that website that's been recently established called
LimarTechNet.com, you'll see the K2RIW bubble explanation. In other words, in my opinion, a radio wave coming out of an antenna looks like an expanding bubble if you could slow it down. It's moving at the speed of light, but it's an expanding bubble. And certain portions of the bubble are brighter than other portions. And there are multiple bubbles inside of each other, all coming out of that antenna. The distance between the bubbles is the wavelength. Everyone thinks the wavelength is something that's a horizontal, as long as the 80-meter dipole, if you know what I mean. Absolutely not.
Repeater, time out.
So, the real wavelength is the distance between the bubbles. Each bubble represents the very next cycle coming out of the transmitter, being transmitted by that antenna. And so, you go to a higher and higher frequency. What's really happening is the bubbles are closer and closer together. The bubbles look to you like they're at right angles to the surface of the bubbles is at right angle to the direction of propagation. And yet you put your antenna in there, parallel to the surface of the bubble, so to speak. And you make the antenna a particular length. You think the antenna is matching the wavelength of the signal being transmitted. Not really. You set that antenna, that length, because it electronically resonates. In order for the antenna to operate, the signal has to bounce back and forth on the antenna 20 times before it gets transmitted. You could say it bounces back 20 times before it goes down the feed line when you're receiving. That's not quite an accurate model, but it comes close. So the signal has to bounce back and forth. You want all those bounces to be co-phase, in step with each other. We call that resonance. That's what sets the length of that 80-meter dipole at 132 feet. Not because the wave itself is 132 feet long, if you know what I mean. Because it's the spacing between the bubbles that are hitting the antenna broadside. Okay. Once you radiate a radio signal, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. Let me drop. I guess it was a couple of weeks ago somebody was saying that, hey, if I build a real good screen room, I can stop the signal from getting there. The answer is absolutely not. You build the most perfect screen room in the world where you do antenna testing, where you do electromagnetic compatibility testing of your particular exotic airplane, and you don't want the satellites overhead learning what kind of a jamming technique you're working on. So you've got this beautiful shielded room, and I've worked on one of those. One of the world's largest anechoic chambers is the one at Edwards Air Force Base, the Benfield Anechoic Facility. 1.5 acres of floor space, roughly 300-foot square floor space, 7 stories high, quarter-inch thick steel, carefully welded on all of the joints with bubble detectors to make sure there's no voids in the joints, double shielded door and whatever. That room is rated for 100 decibels of shielding capability. I can't think of the word they use for it. And so you would think that all signals stop going into that room or out of the room. Absolutely not. You build a real sensitive receiver, you put it in the middle of that room, and if there's a broadcast station out in Lancaster, California, and that's the nearest town, that broadcast station is receivable inside that room. Because of the shielding of the room, the radio signal getting in there is 100 decibels weaker, but you can't stop it from going there. You can attenuate it somewhat, you can make it weaker by shielding. And maybe the shielding is good enough to do everything you want, but it never stops. The signal goes everywhere. So the signal goes everywhere in distance. It goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe once you transmit what I'm calling a radio wave. Let me drop. And the model in my brain tells me that as I go to higher and higher frequencies, the bubbles of that transmitted signal are really closer and closer together. Each individual next bubble, so to speak, is the next cycle. And the space in between the bubbles is the wavelength. And so I used to think that you would get a nosebleed if you went as high as 100 gigahertz in frequency. Well, then I talked to some of the buddies that I worked at AIL. I'll think of his name in a minute. The chief scientist. I'll have to look him up in my... I'm forgetting a lot of things these days. Anyhow, he was doing work at 680 gigahertz in 1964 when I joined the company. This guy, I'm going to think of his name in a minute, 640 gigahertz. There are guys who have done work at 1,000 gigahertz, 2,000 gigahertz. It's really called the terahertz techniques.
yes, there was far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. And the thing that happens as you go higher and higher frequency is in each individual, let me call it particle of the energy. Let me drop it. Call it a corpus hole, call it a, what's the word I'm looking for? Particle, the minimum photon, that's the good word I'm going to look for. Each photon of energy, the smallest particle of energy that you can transmit, call it a photon, that photon becomes more and more energetic as the frequency is higher. That's the reason why anything above ultraviolet, we call it ionizing. The individual photons of transmitted signal of ultraviolet and higher frequencies, the smallest particle has enough energy that when it hits your body, it is capable of creating disruption of your cells, your DNA, whatever. It can create cancer. So when you go higher in frequency than near ultraviolet, you're into the ionizing energy. In other words, it is capable of separating electrons from their nucleus of individual molecules. It's therefore capable of disturbing your DNA. It's capable of scrambling your DNA a little bit and possibly giving you a cancer. You go to higher and higher frequencies, the energy gets stronger and stronger. What's the limit? Every time we build a detector, a gamma ray detector, and right now the biggest one that's in service at this time is the Alpha Gamma Ray Telescope that was about a year or two ago mounted on the International Space Station. And every time we build a gamma ray detector and put it in space, you eventually see a burst of energy coming out of some galaxy that's doing some weird thing. Let me drop it. Which is strong enough to saturate your detector. Every detector we have ever put into space eventually gets hit with a burst of energy that will saturate it. And even the alpha gamma ray detector that was put up there, the alpha gamma ray telescope, a year or two ago on the International Space Station, it has detected a couple of very interesting things, a whole lot of, not high in percentage, but still a whole lot of events that represent negative energy. In other words, positive charged electrons and negative charged protons, so to speak. Negative energy or reverse polarity energy, you know what I mean. So it appears to me that some of those galaxies out there could all be the complete opposite, a mirror image of us, if you know what I mean, where their electrons are positively charged and their protons are negatively charged, and their neutrons are probably still neutral. But as some of those stars go into a supernova or as individual white dwarfs and black holes coalesce or two black holes come together, let me drop. You get a burst of energy that's bigger than anything you can imagine. I see no limit. We have all kinds of limits. When I first cut my engineering teeth, and let me pick a number, 1964, when I came out of Pratt Institute, to me at that time, anything above 100 megacycles was a super high frequency. Transistors didn't go there. A very few number of tubes could go there. And that was, any higher than that, you would get a nosebleed. 100 megacycles looked to me like a frontier. As time passed and I started working for a progressive company, 1,000 megahertz looked like a frontier. And then 10,000. And then 100,000. And then 1,000,000. 1,000 gigahertz, if you know what I mean. A terahertz. Where's the limit? I see no evidence of a limit there, Joe. The pieces of equipment that could generate those signals, the pieces of equipment that could receive those signals, the transistors didn't go high enough, the diodes didn't go high enough. In 1964, to get beyond 100 megacycles, you had to work real hard. Nowadays, I could say, to get beyond 1,000 gigahertz, you have to work real hard. It's just a matter of deriving the electronics, deriving the hardware, deriving the techniques for detection and generation. There seems to be no limit. As you go higher in frequency, the same size antenna gives you a more narrow beamwidth, it's giving you more focus. In the case of outer space, you get longer and longer distance of transmission if you go higher and higher in frequency. Looks to me like the frontier is up. And there's one other thing going on with ham radio. Let me drop it.
C2IS, query.
Bill, recognize, get to you in a minute, Bill. And that is, If you look at what ham radio has been doing, the hams are, in some cases, radio-wise, very near the frontier. The really progressive hams in 1960 were getting on the super high frequency called 2 meters, and a few of them were fiddling around with 432 megahertz. Each decade that you look at ham radio, the hams have a brand new frontier that is almost 10 times higher in frequency. Moore's law tells you that you double the number of transistors every 18 months on the state-of-the-art components that you're building, your microprocessor chips. And Moore's law also says you double the number of lines of code every 2 years on the things that you're producing. I could say every decade, the ham radio operators go 10 times higher in frequency, and there seems to be no limit. There are guys really doing, for instance, Brian Justin, WA1, can't think of his call letters right now, AIM, I think it is. He has done communicating, two-way communication at 440 gigahertz, and he's dreaming about going higher. There's not a whole lot of guys there, but if you like working at the frontier, there really is one, and you can break through it if you know what I mean. So all the evidence I see, Joe, tells me that Mother Nature has no limit. Only mankind has the limit temporarily. And for a curious set of guys, guys with enough curiosity and the right kind of enthusiasm, maybe backed up with the right kind of a laboratory and a couple of real good mentors, you're going to go higher in frequency and generate the hardware that can detect the signals, that can generate the signals, that can transmit the signals, that can focus the signals. And so, there ain't no limit, as I...
Repeater, time out.
As I see it, Joe, there is no limit. W2LYY, wonder if that's close to what you were looking for, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet. Good question.
W2LYY. Well, somewhat. What I'm getting at is, I guess maybe ultimately, is you're measuring wavelength up there in nanometers. Okay, so the higher you go, the nanometers, the number is going to shrink and shrink and shrink until you get something at a wavelength of 1 nanometer or a tenth of a nanometer. That's what it's getting at. As far as you understand physics, you don't think there's a limit. You could just the wavelength can be it just keep like getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Now, what happens if you start approaching the wavelength of what or the distance of these bubbles, so to speak, that actually are becoming the size of a photon? If that's what's conveying this energy point to point, do you reach limit when you reach their physical size, or can you actually go beyond that? What do you think?
If you calculated what's happening to the electrons on a super low frequency, 60 hertz, the power line that's that socket in the wall that's powering your ham radio equipment right now, and that light bulb that's on the table with you, that 60 hertz signal, you would think that those signals are flowing back and forth. They really are marbles in the pipe. And you calculate how far the marbles are moving when you're drawing 100 amperes. When you're drawing 1 ampere out of that socket to power a 100-watt light bulb, how far are those electrons moving? And I think the answer is a very small fraction of an inch. At 60 hertz, okay, I now go up to 10 gigahertz, a frequency that I have used, and you give me a fairly weak signal, a milliwatt signal, at 10,000 megahertz frequency, how far does the electron move on that wire of that dipole of that antenna or the probe that's inside that waveguide, the coax adapter that's launching the signal? How far does that electron move, wiggling back and forth on each half cycle? You do that calculation and you say to yourself, I don't believe it. I must have made a math error. You'll rapidly calculate that the electron is moving not only a small fraction of the diameter of the copper molecule that that little probe is made out of, but we're now getting down to amounts of motion that are smaller than the nucleus of the copper molecule. And if you go to a weak enough signal at a high enough frequency, the amount of wiggle back and forth of those electrons is a small fraction of the distance that's the diameter of a proton or maybe even a quark. How in the world can you get into subatomic size of motion of the electrons and yet that signal propagates out of there, happy as all hell, and goes out into space and 430 miles away a guy hears it, and I've done that.
Repeater, time out.
And I rapidly said to myself, how in the world did a signal where each wavelength is roughly 1 inch at 10 gigahertz, and the number of billions of wavelengths between me and that guy in Rodan, North Carolina, that I'm talking to, on single sideband, on 10 gigahertz, how in the world did the signal go that many wavelengths downrange, way beyond the radio horizon, without getting tired, without being scattered, without being dissipated? How in the world did that signal get there? That's the magic of wireless. Ain't easy to explain how it does it, but it does it. And so, I don't see any limit, Joe. Something fancy. Each individual photon has more and more energy. That's why, beyond a certain frequency, like near ultraviolet, we call it ionizing radiation. The smallest particle you transmit, so to speak, call them photons, will, when they hit things, do, let's call it damage, or at least they'll do disruption. And so, how much disruption is a function of how strong is that signal? So, when you're working with things like ultraviolet and above, make sure you're protecting your eyes. Make sure you don't expose your skin to a whole lot of it. Otherwise, you're going to get sunburned or something even worse. But I see no limit, Joe. When you get down to the radio wave itself, the wavelength or the movement of the electrons that constitutes the radio wave on the antenna, let me drop. And you're way beyond the size of subatomic size. And the particles that make up an atom, and you're talking about wavelengths and motions of the electrons that are much smaller than the sizes of the protons and neutrons and probably the electrons themselves. If you're moving the electron a small fraction of the diameter of the electron, I think I've heard an electron has an approximate diameter of around 10 to the minus 31 meters. My goodness, is that small. Nano type stuff. And yet, that radio wave is happy to propagate into space, and I'm awful glad it does it, because by way of those transmissions, that sun is making all kinds of energy, through that hard vacuum of space, all of the energy comes out of that sun, it hits our planet, warms us up, creates the rain, the wind, the clouds, the blue sky, and whatever. I'm awful glad that those radio waves are able to move through that complete vacuum. And what is it that does it? There's not a single electron that has to move. When I was listening to those astronauts on the moon during Apollo 15 and 16, not a single electron left that moon. But this thing called radio wave left that moon, went through 250,000 miles of space, came down to my little 12-foot diameter homebrew parabolic dish antenna in Farmingdale, and it picked up astronaut audio, played it out of the loudspeaker, and we all sat there with a big smile on our face, wondering how in the world did Mother Nature do that. I think we amateurs, let me drop.
It's 2QAQ with a comment.
Yeah, we got Bill first and then Greg next. We amateurs are going to be asking the question, the curious ones among us are going to be asking the question, will a human brain ever be able to understand the workings of a human brain? Will a human brain ever be able to really understand what is a radio wave and how the hell does it propagate? We got a bunch of theories, we got a bunch of models that work most of the time. But the model doesn't really tell you where the rubber meets the road, what is really happening. How does all that magic happen? I've been working in that field for 45 years. I've got the curiosity. I only think I partially understand it. I got a bunch of rules of thumb that work for me when I'm designing antennas, when I'm designing transmitters, when I'm designing receivers, when I'm designing feed lines, and when I'm talking about how a waveguide goes, how a signal goes down a waveguide. I got a bunch of mental models that work for me. I've never seen any of them, if you know what I mean. It's just a model that I have to correct from time to time. I have to improve the model because it's the best I've got. AC2IS was the first guy. Go ahead, Bill. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. I have two questions at this point. First one is, you said something about the distance that an electron would move being smaller than the size of the nucleus of that atom, even, you know, at such a high frequency, which seemed to imply that, you know, at a high frequency, electrons would not move as much, which I think is not right. I think, you know, power being the area under the curve, and the peak of that curve is basically going to determine
fitted up with a resistor between the positive lead and the negative lead. I know that electrons are flowing out of the negative lead, going through that wire, and going to the positive lead. I can talk about the speed of those electrons, and by the way, the speed is extremely slow. When your car battery is dishing out 200 amperes into your starter motor with a locked rotor at the beginning when you first turn the key on a cold winter day, 200 amperes are flowing out of your battery through that copper lead towards that starter motor. At that current level, the blue electron leaving the battery right now, all the electrons are normally red, but there's a blue one coming out of the battery, and I'm keeping track of it. It takes 4 hours for that blue electron to get from the battery to the starter motor at 200 amperes. What's really going on is that there's a zillion electrons in that copper pipe, in that copper cable between the battery and the starter motor. And it's a bunch of marbles in the pipe. Yes, when one marble jumps out of the end of the pipe and goes into the starter motor, within 3 nanoseconds, because that cable is 3 feet long, within 3 nanoseconds, the battery knows about it. It senses a lower pressure of the marbles in the pipe, and the battery issues another marble to keep everything balanced. So the propagation of the event of current being flowed happens at a nanosecond per foot. But each individual electron, because there's so damn many of them, takes 4 hours to get there at 200 amperes. So if I now take a 60 hertz wave, I could break it down a millisecond at a time. For a certain period of time, the 60 cycle wave coming out of the wall socket at my house, let me drop it. For a certain period of time, the wave coming out of the socket of the wall at 60 hertz is positive for a few milliseconds. It is positive. During that time, I know which direction the electrons are flowing. And I know how, I can calculate how fast they're flowing. And on the next half cycle, I've got negative wave coming out, negative voltage coming out of the socket, and now the electrons are going back in the other direction. Even at 60 hertz, at 1 ampere of flowing into my 100 watt light bulb, how far do those electrons move? They're wiggling back and forth at a 60 cycle rate, and how far do they really move? It's an extremely small fraction of an inch. If I go to a higher frequency at the exact same number of amperes, at the exact same diameter of conductor, I've now spent a smaller period of time with the signal being positive and the electrons are flowing to the right, and a smaller period of time that the wave is negative in polarity and the electrons are flowing to the left. Because the timing of a higher frequency is shorter, positive, and shorter number of microseconds, positive and negative, the electrons don't get a chance to move as far. You carry that analysis far enough, and you go to 10 gigahertz, as I've done. And 10 gigahertz and a 1 watt signal, how far do the electrons move? It's an extremely small fraction of the inner workings of the molecules of the copper itself that makes up the antenna. We're getting down to subatomic level as to the direct, the amount of motion the electrons are doing in that very fast timing. You see where I'm going with that one now, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW, and the defense.
I do see where you're going with that, Dick. And then my second question is, if you're able to generate a certain frequency, should you also be able to think that somebody would be able to build a receiver that would receive that frequency, AC2IS?
Okay. When I strike a match, a certain amount of the energy of that flame or that match is at 3,000, 4,000 kelvins. It's a very high temperature. With very simple techniques, like striking a match, I can generate 3,000 Kelvin, which is around, I'm not sure of the exact number, it's probably around 1 micron of wavelength is the majority of that energy. The wavelength of the energy coming out of the flame of that match is around 1 micron, 1,000 nanometers. I can generate it. For me to, if I didn't have a whole lot of knowledge of building infrared detectors, I might not be able to detect it. In some cases, generating it is easy. The earliest transmitters of radio signals were spark gap transmitters. The actual frequency range that's going on in that plasma of that arc that takes place in a spark gap transmitter, it's got
a hell of a lot of the frequencies from DC to light. And I'm only half kidding when I say DC to light. So generating them in some cases, I'll admit that you're generating them very non-coherently in that spark gap. Let me drop them. But to build a real good super heterodyne receiver that can, with full sensitivity, receive that 1,000 nanometer, 1 micron wavelength signal coming out of that match flame, to build a state-of-the-art detector for that is even today high technology, even though it's so easy to generate. So we can all make noise. Radio noise, optical noise, you know, out of your mouth. We can all generate the signal. That's the easy part. Getting state-of-the-art threshold sensitivity detection of the signal, that's where the science really begins. And then when you go further down range, there's a huge advantage of abandoning the spark gap transmitters like they had to do in the mid-1920s and 1930s and go over to coherent crystal-controlled transmitters and receivers. Once you did that, you picked up a huge advantage, but you had to work at it. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Thanks, Dick. So I guess I should rephrase my question. If I can generate a clean, stable sine wave at a certain very high frequency, then I should be able to expect a super heterodyne system to work with that as part of a receiver. Is that correct? AC2IS.
You're getting into a philosophy here now. I think that's correct, Bill, but not always. I know that I could make X-rays, and Wes and 2XJN has experimented with things like this. I can start off with a high-voltage circuit where I can generate X-rays. To really get state-of-the-art detection of those X-rays is difficult. And so particularly a focal plane array of those so I can get a nice image out of that. Very difficult. So I'm going to continue saying that generating it is an order of magnitude more easy than building a state-of-the-art receiver. I'll admit that his X-ray generating machine is not going to be coherent. To make coherent X-rays, yes, that's damn difficult. You might be right. I'm going to think about that some more, Bill. KC2QIQ. K2LIW. What would you like to add to all this, Glenn? We're trying to get down to the bedrock here. You've got it, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Just a couple of quick comments about all of the above. I think that there definitely is a limit to the electromagnetic spectrum for EM waves, and I'll get to that just in a second. But, you know, I think when you were talking about the match before, light is in the hundreds of nanometers in wavelength. X-rays, 100 and just under 100 nanometers in wavelength. Atomic structure, when you start getting to the smallest atoms, you're somewhere bottoming out around 1 nanometer. And I think for electromagnetic waves, Dick, I don't think that you could ever generate or detect any electromagnetic wave in something even around 1 nanometer. So I'll be a little bit bold here and make the suggestion that the electromagnetic wave spectrum as we know it, with our periodic chart and all the elements that we understand in our universe, will end somewhere probably at something larger than 1 nanometer. KC2QIQ.
I don't think that's true, Glenn. The alpha magnetic spectrometer, alpha gamma ray, alpha spectrometer, that's mounted on the International Space Station right now, it is detecting gamma rays. First of all, a small molecule, a hydrogen molecule, the radius is in the vicinity of an angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meters. That's a tenth of a nanometer is the diameter of the radius of a hydrogen molecule. And the nucleus is 10 to the minus 15 meters, a thousand times smaller yet. Is it a thousand? Yeah. No, it's 100,000 times. The nucleus